content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Welcome back. This issue is dated June 24th, 2019. We go right to the back of the book to make sure that we get in this week's interview feature. This edition is called 8 Questions. The interview subject is Larry Diamond. Time says, the Stanford scholar known as Mr. Democracy on the shrinking free world, the U.S.'s irreplaceable role in it, and his book, Ill Winds. First question. Earlier this year, the watchdog organization Freedom House reported the 13th straight year of decline for democracy across the globe. You've been teaching the subject for 30 years. How bad are things? Answer. It's an emerging crisis. It's not the 1930s. We don't have the situation where a blatantly fascist party has conquered a democracy. It's more subtle, creeping, and incremental process. But there's this sense, as there was in the 1920s and 1930s, that it's the authoritarian regimes or the current neo-fascist movements that have the energy, the dynamism, the popular engagement. Question. You say Hungary no longer qualifies as a democracy, and Poland is on the edge. Answer. It's a dark period that we're living through now. Unfortunately, part of the darkness has descended on Europe, and that's supposed to be part of the core bastion of freedom and democracy. Question. Democracy is more than elections, but in its complexity, you describe an, quote, outsized role for political leaders, unquote. You find a lot to criticize in President Trump, but does saying it risk further polarizing politics? Answer. I've struggled with that, but you have an American president who is engaging in a lot of undemocratic behavior, doing the kinds of things that other autocrats have been doing step by step to try and suffocate democracy in their countries. The first line of defense is to call that out. Question. If a U.S. president is not advocating for democracy, who picks up the slack? Answer. Without U.S. leadership, at best, we're going to have drift. At worst, we'll have a rout of the existing democracies in tenuous places. Question. So, nobody? Answer. Not quite. But no state will act decisively and effectively to secure and defend democratic progress in the world unless the U.S. is in the lead. There will not be another leader. Answer. Question. How important is income inequality in all this? Answer. If you look at the constituency for illiberal, generally right-of-center populism, it's the same constituency for Donald Trump in the U.S., for Brexit in Britain, for Marine Le Pen in France, for Alternative for Germany in Germany. The world is passing them by. They lack the skill levels to compete in this globalized economy, and so they feel threatened by international trade, threatened by globalization, threatened by immigration, threatened by a world that's changing very rapidly and that is not the old familiar. And reinforcing income insecurity is the sense that they're looked down upon, that this cosmopolitan elite looks upon them as backward, as hacks, as reactionaries, as defenders of a bygone era. And they're not entirely wrong in their perception. There is a cultural arrogance. Question. What role does the social media play? Answer. The incentive of the social media companies is to perpetuate outrage. The more we're riveted, the more time we spend on those platforms, and the more ads we see, So the revenue logic of Facebook is not consistent with the interests of democracy. Question. In your new book, you describe Vladimir Putin as a burglar walking down a hallway testing doorknobs while China quietly creates a system to replace the one the U.S. led since World War II. What's the bigger danger? Answer. Chinese President Xi Jinping is constructing a neo-totalitarian Orwellian surveillance state that is more repressive of human liberty than anything we've seen since Mao. And here, I think Donald Trump is doing some positive things to confront Chinese technology theft and China's undemocratic influence efforts in the U.S. Final question. Is it hard being known as Mr. Democracy? Final answer. I just kind of grin and bear it. Entire interview with Larry Diamond, Stanford scholar known as Mr. Democracy. Interview conducted for Time by Carl Vick. That book, again, the title is Ill Winds, the author Larry Diamond. We go now to the beginning of the issue, and we start with the regular feature called For the Record. Time always leads off with For the Record, which is a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing or a caption in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by the number in red, 43. Caption explains, new world record for most paw shakes, alternating sides, in 30 seconds. Yes, new world record for most paw shakes, alternating sides, in 30 seconds. Set by Rachel Grills and her Jack Russell Terrier, Jacob, at the May 11th and 12th Dog Fest in Hertfordshire, England. 43 shakes, 30 seconds. That item is accompanied by a two-color drawing of Rachel and Jacob. And yes, they are shaking hands and, well, paws. In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Fred Swanaker, Ghanaian entrepreneur, on his vision for the African Leadership University in Mauritius, which he founded 4 years ago. The quotation from Ghanaian entrepreneur Fred Swanaker, quote, it's time that Africa had its own Stanford and MIT and Harvard, unquote. Caption goes on to say, the school's first graduating class received diplomas on June 12th. On the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from more than 180 CEOs representing over 108,000 workers on a recent wave of restrictive state laws on abortion in a June 10th open letter. The quotation from more than 180 CEOs, quote, bad for business, unquote. Caption goes on to say, they made an economic argument against such bans. On the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Jon Stewart, former host of Comedy Central's The Daily Show, speaking to a subcommittee of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee on June 11th, about the delayed reauthorization of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. And the quotation from Jon Stewart, quote, what an incredible metaphor this room is. Behind me, a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress, unquote. In the lower left corner of the page, the story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $58 million. Caption explains, estimated cost of a round-trip ticket to the International Space Station. NASA announced June 7th that private citizens could soon be able to pay their way. $58 million. In the center left margin of the page is a story illustrated by the sports score in bright red, 13-0. 13-0. Caption explains, final score in the U.S.-Thailand Women's World Cup match on June 11th. The U.S. team set a new scoring record for the tournament. U.S. 13, Thailand nothing. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from James P. O'Neill, New York City Police Commissioner, on June 6th in the NYPD's first apology for its June 28, 1969 raid on the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in Manhattan's West Village. Quotation from New York City Police Commissioner James P. O'Neill, quote, the actions taken by the NYPD were wrong, unquote. Caption goes on to say, the patrons who fought back are considered by many to have launched the modern LGBTQ rights movement. In the right center of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, TV. Studies suggest sleeping with TV on may lead to weight gain in women. Under Bad Week, radio. Radiohead delights fans with public release of music stolen by hackers. In the left center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Mindy Kaling, actor, arguing that Hollywood casts are getting more diverse only because studios are afraid of being called out. In a June 7th New York Times interview, the quotation from Mindy Kaling, quote, the encouragement is not coming from a sense of how great it would be. It's from fear, unquote. With the entire contents of the For the Record page. Now we are in the major section, the brief, and the subsection is opener. And this section in the subsection is the bulletin, where the headline is, quote, persecuted, unquote, Russian journalist released from house arrest after protests. Article by Billy Perigo, who writes, Russian investigative journalist Ivan Golunov made his career writing the news, revealing corruption among Moscow's elite for the news site Medusa. But he became the subject of headlines himself after he was arrested on trumped-up charges of drug trafficking that could have landed him 20 years in prison. After a public outcry and scrutiny from Russia's remaining independent media, he was released on June 11th when police conceded lack of evidence. Activists hailed it as a rare victory amid a sea of repression. There is more to this article, but in the interest of getting more material into our reading, we will move on. And part of that that we want to include is the sidebar feature sharing this page, the regular feature called News Ticker. It's three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top news item. Canada plans ban on single-use plastics. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on June 10th that Canada will ban many single-use plastic items such as bags, straws, and cutlery as early as 2021. Less than 10% of the more than 3 million tons of plastic thrown out annually in Canada is recycled, according to government figures. Little item. DOJ to turn over Mueller documents. After weeks of negotiations, House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler said on June 10th that the Justice Department had agreed to give Congress crucial evidence collected by Robert Mueller. The move will allow Democrats to use that information to keep investigating President Trump. Bottom item, Venezuela opens border with Colombia. Authorities said more than 30,000 Venezuelans crossed into Colombia on June 8th, many in search of food and basic goods, after Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro opened the border. He had closed it in February during a dispute over U.S.-backed attempts to bring aid trucks into his crisis-stricken country. And moving forward, we are now at the milestones page, where the lead item, underdyed, Dr. John, embodiment of a city's sound. Observance by Terrence Blanchard. Time notes, Blanchard is a Grammy-winning trumpeter and composer. Terrence Blanchard writes, like so many musicians from New Orleans, Malcolm John Rabenek Jr., known as Dr. John, played music for the pure love of it. That love allowed him to be himself. I first encountered him when I was on tour in Japan in the 1980s. He was doing a double bill with the Neville Brothers, and when we saw those guys, it was almost like we were back home. Mac was a sweetheart, and when I would see him, we'd talk about New Orleans and the things New Orleans talk about, which is mostly food and parties. He loved to cook, and I remember he told me how good possum was. I said, Mac, I haven't made that journey yet. And he said, possum is some good eating, man. It broke my heart to hear that he passed away on June 6th at age 77, because he was such a typical illustration of what it means to be from the city. He was a combination of Cajun, blues, and jazz. A little of everything, and you can hear it in the way he played piano, in the bluesy style of how he sang. He created music that touched people around the world, but he didn't allow the world to change who he was. Throughout his life, he was always the guy who carried the culture and spirit of the city wherever he went. Dr. John, along with Professor Longhair, created a sound that is uniquely associated with the history of New Orleans. Whenever you start to think about that city, those are the names that will pop into your head. Terrence Blanchard writing about Dr. John. This item is accompanied by a black and white photograph, and the caption says, Dr. John, seen here in 2014, released his first album, Gree Gree, in 1968, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2011. In the right margin of the page, under one, and one is spelled W-O-N, Ali Stroker, a historic Tony. Observance by Abigail Abrams. Ali Stroker's turn as Ado Annie in Daniel Fish's revival of Oklahoma has been hailed as funny and sexy and a vital part of the fresh edge this production has brought to the classic musical. On June 9th, the performance became a historic one, too, when Stroker became the first actor who uses a wheelchair to take home a Tony Award. Stroker, who was also the first wheelchair user to star in a Broadway show in the 2015 revival of Spring Awakening, called her featured actress win a huge moment for representation. Quote, this award is for every kid who is watching tonight who has a disability, a limitation, a challenge, who has been waiting to see themselves represented in this arena, unquote, she said, quote, you are, unquote. But it was also a reminder of the work left to be done. There was no ramp or lift to the stage, so Stroker had to wait backstage in case she won. Later, she spoke about how theaters need to become more accessible for performers like her, who she had already made clear are done lingering in the wings. That was the entire observation by Abigail Abrams, Ally Stroker, Tony Award. This item is accompanied by a full-color, full-length photograph of Ally Stroker holding her Tony in her wheelchair. Her gown is bright yellow. Under decriminalized, homosexuality by Botswana's High Court on June 11th. Three judges voted to overturn colonial-era laws that carried prison terms of up to 7 years. Under crashed, a helicopter on the roof of a New York City office building on June 10th. The pilot, the only person aboard, was killed. Authorities said there was no sign of terrorism. Underplanned, the use of an army base in Oklahoma that served as a Japanese internment camp in World War II to hold migrant children by the Trump administration. Under rejected, the idea that gender identity can be fluid by the Vatican on June 10th in a document that called the concept a threat to families. Under announced, that Brigadier General Laura Yeager will be the first woman to lead a U.S. Army infantry division when she takes command of the 40th Infantry on June 29th. Brigadier General Laura Yeager to lead the 40th Infantry Division, U.S. Army. Under sentenced, six Indian men on charges related to the rape of an 8-year-old girl in 2018. Sentenced by an Indian court on June 10th. The case had caused national outrage. Six Indian men. Under granted a building permit for Antoni Gaudi's Sagrada Familia Basilica by Barcelona on June 8th. The move came 137 years after construction began. That was the entire contents of the milestones page. On the facing page is another edition of the feature news ticker, and once again at the sidebar with three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Pence defends policy on pride flags. Vice President Mike Pence said on June 10th that it was the, quote, right decision, unquote, for the State Department to reject requests from U.S. embassies to fly the rainbow flag on flagpoles during LGBTQ Pride Month. Many had hoisted pride flags in past Junes, and some embassies have done so again this year in defiance of the policy. Middle item, nearly 100 killed in attack on Mali village. At least 95 people were killed in a nighttime raid on an ethnic Dogon village in central Mali, officials said on June 10th. The attack came amid rising tensions in the area as semi-nomadic Fulani Muslims vie with villages for resources, and the expansion of Islamic extremism destabilizes the country. Final item. Immigrants in California get health care. California is using a budget surplus to expand the state's health care program to cover undocumented immigrants under age 26. The move, set to go into effect in January, will make the state the first to allow undocumented adults to enroll in state-funded health insurance. Moving ahead, we're in the brief, and now the brief section called Time With, and the subject this time is CEO Lili Leung, CEO of USA Gymnastics. And Time's headline is a question. Can anyone save USA Gymnastics at this point? New CEO Lili Leung is determined to try. Article by Alice Park. There are thankless jobs, and then there is Lili Leung's job as the new president and CEO of USA Gymnastics. Leung oversees an organization that is struggling to justify its existence. After major sponsors walked away following USAG's involvement in one of the worst sex abuse scandals in sports history, the group declared bankruptcy last December and is now in danger of losing its status as the national governing body for the sport in the U.S. Leung is the fourth new head of USAG in 2 years and must now restore the reputation of gymnastics in the U.S. She inherits an organization that many gymnasts feel is working against them. Both gymnasts and USAG officials have revealed that under its previous leadership, it not only failed to immediately report sexual abuse claims to law enforcement, but also tried to keep those reports from becoming public. And even after hundreds of complaints from athletes against one man, former national team doctor Larry Nassar, piled up, USAG appointed a series of people with ties to those involved in the scandal to high-level positions. Parenthetically, in court, more than 150 women and girls, from local athletes to Olympic and world team members, said he sexually abused them over the past two decades, some when they were as young as 8 years old. In 2018, Nassar was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison. End of parenthesis. Some of them believe the only way forward is to raise the organization, raise is spelled R-A-Z-E, and create an entirely new body to represent gymnastics. Leung is betting her career that she can rebuild USAG from the inside. As a former gymnast, she wants to make athletes' concerns more of a priority in order to rebuild the trust that has dissipated like the chalk dust gymnasts clapped her off their hands. She approached USAG last fall when her predecessor resigned. Quote, "I didn't reach out wanting to be CEO," unquote, says Leung. Quote, "If that meant I would volunteer, then I would volunteer," unquote. Heading the organization wasn't exactly a sought-after position, and many potential candidates turned it down. Leung, however, decided to leave a comfortable job at the NBA to take over the disgraced organization. Just 2 months into her tenure, Leung's office at the USAG headquarters in Indianapolis is still devoid of any personal effects. There hasn't been much time for decorating. Between meeting with every staff member and attending competitive events. Parenthetically, the first former gymnast to lead USAG in 20 years. She has even stretched with the junior national team and kept up when they perform splits. A few early mistakes as CEO have raised questions about whether she's up to the task, but haven't shaken her resolve. Quote, "It's not like you can snap your fingers and have everybody completely move on," unquote, says Olympic gold medalist Nastia Liukin. Quote, "It's going to take time," unquote. With the Olympics, gymnastics' grandest showcase looming in just over a year, Leung has scrawled a number, 43, on a whiteboard that occupies an entire wall in her office as a reminder of how urgent her job is. Quote, "It's a timeline for me, a countdown of days," unquote, she says, declining to elaborate further. Leung didn't need this job. As president of global partnerships at the NBA, she was responsible for marketing, negotiating, and nurturing relationships with brands such as Nike, Samsung, and Audi. And her easy friendliness helped her adapt to living around the world in London, Shanghai, Beijing, and New York. But after watching USAG self-destruct over the past few years, she could not sit by any longer. Quote, "I kept telling myself, it's going to get better at some point," unquote, she says. Quote, "Over the course of 2 years, it didn't. Because I gained so much from the sport, I felt it was time to pay it forward," unquote. When she was seven, she and her twin sister, Mei Mei, took their first gymnastic class in Ridgewood, New Jersey. The daring flips and the license to tumble and catapult their bodies to impossible heights left the girls smitten, so Leung's parents soon moved the family to nearby Parsippany so the sisters could train at an elite gym. For 15 years, Leung lived the almost monastic life of an elite athlete, training twice a day for 35 hours a week, missing most of the traditional teenage rites of passage, like football games and school dances. The dedication earned both Leung and her sister gymnastics scholarships to the University of Michigan. And her athletic career even set her up for a less traditional challenge while she was at the NBA, competing in a regional first round of American Ninja Warrior. Parenthetically, the floating steps sunk her. In her new role, she is focused on enforcing new athlete safety policies to protect gymnasts. She has been advised not to reach out to sexual abuse survivors involved in pending lawsuits, although some have contacted her. She told attorneys on the Survivors Committee that when she can, she wants to meet with them. Quote, "I don't see them as adversaries at all," unquote, she says. Quote, "I want to hear from them and would love them to be part of the solution going forward," unquote. There is more to this article, but we are moving on to include more other material. However, I am including a featured quotation in red from Lili Leung, president and CEO of USA Gymnastics. And the featured quotation is, quote, "Because I gained so much from the sport, I felt it was time to pay it forward," unquote. Also, before we go, Alice Park, the author, has included a fact-faced mini-feature in the center of the article called Li Yong Quick Facts, and there are three items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, balancing act. At Michigan, Li Yong competed as a gymnast on four Big Ten Conference Championship teams and was named Academic All-Big Ten three times. Middle item, building bridges. As a consultant in London, Li Yong advised Arsenal on growing its presence in China and helped the UFC secure sponsors in Europe. Bottom item, still tumbling. Quote, even though my schedule is busy, I try to work out or at a minimum stretch each day, unquote, she says. Quote, gymnastics never really leaves you, unquote. Moving ahead, and we are now in the next major section called The View. And leading off is the subsection, Parenting, where the headline is, What a Father Can Do, article by David French. Time says French is a Time columnist. He writes, When I was 7 years old, my father resigned from his job as a college professor. It was a critical moment in his career and created real financial risk for his young family. But he felt that he was being asked to violate his principles, and nothing was more important to him than a strong moral code. That bold decision was a model of my father's approach to raising his kids. Walk your talk. Live your values. Provide for and protect your family. He told me to be kind to women, sure, but I watched him love and honor my mother. He exhorted me to work hard, but the lesson struck because I saw him grind night after night as he went back to school to get another degree and took on side jobs to help pay the bills. I think back on his example often as I try to be the best father I can to my own children. Raising kids has never been an easy job for anyone, of course, but the challenge of helping boys find their way to a purposeful adult life is particularly fraught these days. With good reason, many of the most harmful attributes associated with traditional masculinity are being re-examined. But as we reckon with the damage of these freighted expectations, we can't lose sight of the essential role fathers play in shaping sons into men of character. As a father, I constantly ask myself the question, quote, what can I do to show my son the way, unquote. That's one reason I joined the military later in life and deployed to Iraq. I did not want to pressure any of my children to follow my literal lead and enlist, but rather to demonstrate to them as best as I could what it looked like to be more committed to your country and to your family than to yourself. Our actions as fathers represent the markers that men lay down, the decisions they point to that say, quote, I don't always have wisdom. I may be at a loss for words, but let me show you what it's like to be a man, unquote. It's hard to imagine life without my father's influence, that there are children by the millions who can't comprehend life with a good father. Is not just painful to contemplate, it also represents an individual and cultural cataclysm. The message to men should be clear and unmistakable. Fatherhood is a non-delegable duty, and your son needs you every bit as you needed your own dad. As a boy blazes his trail through life, his father should be leading the way. David French, Time columnist. Sharing this page is the sidebar feature, Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. It consists of three samples stacked one on top of the other. Top sample, A War of Words. Americans and Brits have battled over the English language for centuries, and not just about an extra U here and there. But according to Peter Martin, author of The Dictionary Wars, The American Fight Over the English Language, quote, they have always been able to understand their insults of one another, unquote. That book title again, The Dictionary Wars, : The American Fight Over the English Language, author Peter Martin. Middle sample, The Witches Among Us. Over the past 150 or so years, witches have gone from frightening figures to inspirational ones, writes Pam Grossman, author of Waking the Witch, Reflections on Women, Magic, and Power. And how you feel about them could be revealing. Quote, show me your witches and I'll show you your feelings about women, unquote. The title of that book, again, is Waking the Witch, : Reflections on Women, Magic, and Power. Author Pam Grossman. Bottom sample, All in the Family. The recent explosion of commercial DNA kits didn't just happen because of scientific advancement, says Nara Milanich, author of Paternity, The Elusive Quest for the Father. The media also played a role by turning ancestry tests into a, quote, deeply alluring cultural phenomenon, unquote. And once again, the title of that book is The Elusive Quest, Paternity, : The Elusive Quest for the Father. Author is Nara, spelled N-A-R-A, Milanich, M-I-L-A-N-I-C-H, Paternity, The Elusive Quest for the Father. All of those are samples from time.com/ideas. On the facing page is the regular feature, The Risk Report, where the headline is, Italy's precarious economy again threatens the EU, by Ian Bremmer. Once again, Italy and the EU are headed toward confrontation. They fought a protracted battle last year over the impact of Italy's budget on its debt before arriving at a compromise in December. But the problem has reemerged, and it's not clear whether a larger fight can be avoided. In recent days, Italy's technocratic prime minister has pledged to resign if leaders of the Five Star Movement and the League, capitalized, the two parties that make up the country's fractious coalition government, fail to put aside differences to agree on a budget the EU will accept, one that won't saddle Italy with ever more dangerous levels of debt. At first, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's threat seemed to have worked. League leader Matteo Salvini and five-star head Luigi Di Maio emerged from a meeting on June 10th talking of a, quote, shared goal, unquote, of avoiding EU action against Italy, quote, while safeguarding economic growth, employment, as well as tax cuts, unquote, according to a statement from Salvini. Quote, I am not interested in fighting with the EU, unquote, Di Maio said on June 11th, quote, but we must get the results Italians are interested in, unquote. The reasoning is straightforward. Italy's economy is weak. The Bank of Italy has cut its 2019 economic growth forecast to 0.3%. Five Star wants to respond by spending more to help people manage hardship, creating a minimum wage, and continuing a, quote, citizens' income, unquote, scheme, similar to the idea of basic income. The League wants sharp personal and corporate tax cuts that its leaders say will jumpstart growth and reduce unemployment. But the EU says Italy is already on track to spend too much. Its rules say Italy must keep deficits at 3%, and the European Commission has forecast a nominal deficit of 3.5% for next year. Italy's budget will violate EU rules. The only real question is by how much and what Brussels will do about it. EU fears are well-founded. Italy's 2.3 trillion euros debt, parenthetically $2.6 trillion, is about 132% of its 2018 economic output. Only Greece is in worse shape, and Greece's economy is small enough that it can be bailed out. Italy's economy, the Eurozone's third largest, is far too big for that. That's why Italy's worries are well-founded. The EU has power to impose fines, cut funding, and order Italy to cut spending and raise taxes to meet its commitments. The greater concern is market fear, underlined by Prime Minister Conte, that ratings agencies could downgrade the country's credit rating, making it more expensive for Italy to borrow. EU action, even if it doesn't come with specific penalties, makes these troubles more likely. Underneath the market jitters are fresh concerns that Five Star and the League are competing with each other to please voters in advance of potential snap elections. Five Star remains the coalition's senior partner, but it's the League that is gaining popularity and political momentum. Both sides know that austerity measures will anger the electorate, and both have won votes in the past by attacking the EU and its rules. The risks of defying those rules forced the two populist parties to climb down last year. That will probably happen again. But this year, Italy's debt could cause more than just political infighting. It could lead to Europe's next major crisis. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. In the right margin is the feature called Quick Talk, and it is a mini-interview. The subject of this interview is Rory Stewart. Time explains, the British lawmaker, a former soldier, diplomat, and author, is running to replace Theresa May as leader of the Conservative Party and become Prime Minister. He has been taking his case directly to the public, inviting people to engage with him on social media and on the streets. Many interview conducted by Anand Girardes, and the first question is, do you think there's something to steal from how the populists use media? Answer, absolutely. I'm the sort of Trumpian anti-Trump. My little video on no-deal Brexit got 2 million views, which is more than he was getting on some of his tweets. Question, Do you think the UK got into a political crisis like this because too many people in power are too removed from everyday people? Answer: British politics is much less elitist, much less class-based than it was 50 years ago. And it's become much more extreme and polarized. Final question. Is Trump someone you could have an honest relationship with? Final answer. I don't think that diplomatic relationships are honest in the way that normal human relationships are honest. Entire mini interview with Rory Stewart, British lawmaker, accompanied by a half-length photograph. Caption says, Stewart leaving 10 Downing Street in May. He's wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and green tie. Moving forward, this article is entitled Hong Kong in Revolt, China's Last Bastion of Freedom Unites Against Beijing, by Phyllis Solomon, Dateline, Hong Kong. The crowds weren't just equipped for a storm. They were counting on one. When rain started to fall on the tens of thousands of mostly young people amassed around Hong Kong's legislature on the morning of June 12th, umbrellas popped open with loud shouts of Ju Yu, a Cantonese cheer meaning add oil, as to a fire. Within hours, the flimsy canopies were flipped sideways and turned into makeshift shields against tear gas and pepper spray fired by local police. They proved less reliable against rubber bullets, however, and might offer no protection at all against the authoritarian forces that loom over the entire island. But the point was to try. The protests were hardly the first in the former British colony since it was handed over to China in 1997. The specter of greater control by communist authorities on the mainland had driven Hong Kongers onto the streets in 2003, 2012, and 2014. But this time, the numbers were greater than ever before, and the escalation carried at least the sense of a showdown. The specific issue at hand was a bill that would allow the extradition of fugitives to stand trial in mainland China. The legislation, fast-tracked by the city's leadership, is widely seen as a threat to the unique freedoms this city of 7 million enjoys. Under the terms of the handover, Hong Kong has operated under a customized model called, quote, One Country, Two Systems, unquote, which gave it a 50-year period of effective self-rule, even though it is part of China. Its history as a lucrative colonial port town left a liberal legacy unique in the People's Republic. Hong Kongers have long lived a freer, more cosmopolitan lifestyle than most Chinese, and prejudice against mainlanders is pervasive. Free speech and an independent press are enshrined in the basic law is capitalized, that has governed the city since the handover. They're proud of their distinct cuisine and language, speaking a Cantonese rather than the Mandarin more common in Greater China. But critics fear that China's encroachment may bring an end to all that. Beijing might use the law to nab opponents and submit them to its notoriously opaque justice system, they say. The risk could extend beyond residents even to visitors who pass through the city's transit hub. Quote, if Hong Kong's extradition bill becomes law, unquote, says Sean King, a former U.S. diplomat in Asia and currently senior vice president for the consultancy firm Park Strategies, quote, I'd think very carefully about visiting again anytime soon, unquote. In other words, the contest for Hong Kong reflects the stakes for the larger world that China seeks to lead. The rise of Beijing has been the major global story of the new century. But its very breadth, the very breadth of that ascent, and the bland labels of the areas where it has edged toward dominance, trade, infrastructure, finance, tech, have served to mask the nature of the system China brings with it. That system is control. On the mainland, the system appears to go unchallenged because control is almost total and cast as conformity. Along with the surveillance state, China's Communist Party has worked to impose a singular vision of Chinese identity in territories where diversity once thrived. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've gained much from this reading. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is designed for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Once again, that's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Number again, 919-832-5138. This is your dedicated reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you again for your presence. We can't do this without you. This is your time. Please join us next time for Time.